Appeals is now in session. Judge Flory, Judge Hooten, Judge Gatiss, the Honorable James B. Flory presiding.
All right. Good morning, everyone. I'm Judge Flory. I'll be the presiding judge here today, and joining me, as indicated, are Judge Gatiss and Judge Hooten on the panel. Just a couple of reminders as we begin. First of all, we do have non-participants that are able to view the arguments today, and I just want to remind everyone that the recording of these proceedings is prohibited by court rule. A recording will be made available shortly after, according to our normal process, but independent recording is prohibited by the rules. The first case on for today is court file 820-0761 in the matter of the welfare of the child of HRB. Each side here, as you know, will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please begin your arguments by identifying yourselves for our record. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Lucas Dawson, and I represent the appellant HRB in this matter. As the court is aware, we are now back for a second time on this case. I realize this is a different panel, but it is no less important that we are back for a second time. If there's anything that I could ask the court specifically to do today, it is that it give this family some finality. Obviously, as the court is aware, my client is asking that this court reverse this case and that this court restore her parental rights under the basis for a variety of reasons, but most importantly, that the county failed to meet its burden and in so doing also violated her due process rights. And so I believe that those are the most important points for the court to consider today. I guess I'm wondering if there are questions that I could start with. Otherwise, I can talk probably for hours about this case, as I've now been on it for approximately 2 years.
I have a question because you seem to imply You seem to imply that on remand that basically it was a restarting of the whole process, or that it had to be a remand for a trial. Am I understanding your argument in that regard?
Your Honor, I apologize. It's harder when we're not in person. So I apologize if there was more to that question.
Okay. I'll try again. There was a remand from our court. What is your understanding as to the scope of that remand?
Thank you. So as far as...
isn't that a key issue as to this argument that you were denied that your client was denied due process?
Your Honor, I believe that is only one of the points that my client was denied due process. As to that point, the court did reverse and remand. And so when looking at that clear language, it was my interpretation, and I realize this court may disagree, but it was my interpretation that as a result of that, my client's rights were restored. And so as a result of that, she was still entitled to due process. And I believe that case law is clear. And in my brief, I believe we cited to, I realize it is an unpublished case, but it can still be considered. And that even upon remand, it is still the burden of the county. It is still the burden. The burden still lies with the county to prove its case. And even in their own brief, they do talk about how at the time of termination, there needs to be grounds to terminate. And when you look at this on a 7 month old. Sorry, was there a question?
But you're not arguing that the original stipulation and the admissions of your client that were made earlier aren't factored into whether there's clear and convincing evidence for termination.
I do believe that the admission that my client made, but that leads into then the second violation that we argue did happen, and that my client made very specific factual admissions as to what would support a termination of parental rights. her very specific factual admissions surrounded complying with her mental health regimen, as well as taking her medications. And then at the termination, the district court essentially said, you have done all of that. You have followed all of those, but then created a different factual basis to terminate her parental rights. And the concern is,
But didn't she admit that she was palpably unfit, and she further agreed that she would comply with all of the conditions that were set forth in Exhibit A to that order?
Your Honor, she
as a condition of the stay.
She did admit that she was palpably unfit when not taking her medications and not complying with her mental health regimen. And that's extremely important. I think it's very nuanced then when you look at what are the grounds to revoke a stay of adjudication. The grounds to revoke a stay of adjudication are twofold. One, do those facts still exist at the time of the termination? Again, she may have admitted that in March, but when we came to the actual revocation hearing, those facts no longer existed. And in fact, the district court found to the contrary. So you can't just say, well, those still exist at this time. And so now all that we are looking at is whether the client violated the conditions.
But and your client agreed that compliance with Exhibit A or failure to comply with Exhibit A to the March 22nd order could result in the revocation of the stay and the termination of her parental rights.
She did agree. She did agree to comply, which then also leads into the second point in the argument that we made, was that when you're looking at the complying with the conditions of the stay, is that this still has to be substantial. And when you're looking at even the testimony of the guardian, which said that essentially my client should not be faulted for a bad day, here she is being faulted for a bad day. And in fact, some of the other arguments were relating back to issues that the county may have felt occurred in the very first case when her daughter was an infant and had nothing to do with the current case. And so when you look at that, when you look at that, the county has to prove all of those factors, they failed. And so that's where the issue comes up, is that the county failed to meet its burden. And failed to meet its burden, quite frankly, not only in the November back at the first appeal, which I realized the Court of Appeals at that point said they were not going to address those arguments, but continued to fail to meet that by then simply asking the district court to simply erase three conclusions of law and just reissue the order. Three, and that again, we get to an additional issue in that by simply erasing three conclusions of law that cannot correct the complete mindset that the district court clearly had. The district court wrote that order with the understanding that there was a presumption, and then simply just deleted three paragraphs as if that somehow cures its original abuse of discretion, and it cannot. And in fact, it's at one point, the district court in the current order still in fact does attempt to shift the burden. And if I could have a moment to find the specific paragraph that I'm thinking of. If the court looks at paragraph, it's finding of fact 99, the court says mother is trying to shift the focus from her and her conduct, arguing that the county and the guardian did not meet its conditions of the stay. Again, all parties, this is a two-way street. Both parties have to comply. Both parties have to cooperate, and we cannot ignore that the burden to prove their case lies with the county. The burden cannot be shifted back to the appellant. And that's
Ms. Dawson. Could I just go back to the questions that Judge Hooten had about the argument that you're making in your brief regarding the resetting of the clock in this case. My understanding from reading the court's order remanding the case was that there was a finding that the district court had erroneously applied a presumption. And then the remand indicated that the district court in its discretion could reopen the factual record. It is also my understanding that back at the district court on the remand, both parties, and that would be your client, agreed not to reopen the factual record. And I'm just wondering, what, if any, effect does your client's agreement not to reopen the factual record have on the argument that you're now making that there was an error in not reopening that record?
And that's a good question. And I can tell you, I definitely considered that one very hard. And we even had some debates in our office as to that one. So I do understand that question. And I took that issue very seriously. When considering then and making the argument, I keep coming back to the fact that it is still the burden of the county. It is not the burden of the appellant to ask to put in more evidence. It's the burden of the agency to prove that there's a factual basis to terminate her parental rights. Essentially, it would be similar to a criminal defendant where they're expected to then come in and put in their own case. It's the burden of the county to prove. And in this case, the county simply said, in fact, in their own memo, the county simply in the conclusion said, asked the court to delete the paragraphs and said that the order still supports the termination and that as the evidentiary burden is met without reopening the record or requiring additional argument, ACSS moves the district court to amend its order without further hearing. So here, the county's argument, again, was that they had already met their burden. That's not my client's burden to prove that they did not meet their burden.
Ms. Dawson, did you present the argument in the district court, however, that the clock was reset, the argument that you're now making that the state, or that the county rather, had a burden to prove at that particular moment in time that that the parent was palpably unfit?
Yeah, yes, I believe in the memorandum of law that I submitted on behalf of my client, I did discuss how, as the evidence sits, there is no evidence that my client was palpably unfit. And in fact, I believe, I apologize, I'm flipping here to it. The conclusion does discuss that the record establishes that ACSS failed to meet its burden, that that the record is complete, and therefore that mother's rights should be restored. So in essence, by simply, and that we ask the court to reunify. So I think when you look at that, we are asking the district court, we're saying at this point, they failed to meet their burden, and therefore the mother's rights should be restored, or mother and the child should be reunified under the understanding that, reunified under the understanding that her rights have been restored. I apologize. I may not have worded that very well.
So, can I just seek a clarification from you? Because as I understand it, I think we have two things going on here. First is when upon the remand, as I understand it, our court basically said the district court incorrectly applied the presumption, and that the district court was seeking a declaration or some factual finding as to whether there was clear and convincing evidence based upon the admissions and stipulations that were made. Is that your understanding? Am I stating that correctly?
I want to make sure I understand your question. So I apologize. So essentially what you're asking is on.
Because I'm going to divide.
What was that? I'm sorry, you broke up.
I'm sorry. I think we're having some bandwidth problems. Because I see two issues. One is whether there was clear and convincing evidence at the time you entered into these stipulations that your client was unfit. But two, there may also be an issue as to whether there was a reason to revoke the stay of adjudication. So I want to split that up as to the first question before the district court was whether there was clear and convincing evidence that she was an unfit parent based on her admissions and stipulation. Am I correct? And that was what the purpose of the remand was as to the first issue?
Correct. I believe the remand was to whether there was actually clear and convincing evidence that she was palpably unfit without the district court applying the burden shift that it had done. So the district court had considered her to be already the presumption, which then in essence under the statute shifts the burden to her. And so our argument all along was that no matter what, at the time of the revocation, there was not clear and convincing evidence that supported a termination of her parental rights based on the law, as well as whether there whether she had in fact violated the conditions of the stay, because the court has to apply both of those. And again, both of those, the law is very clear, have to occur at the time of revocation. So yes, in March, she made an admission. However, those circumstances did not exist at the time of the revocation. And I think that that's persuaded and helpful by the three main, may I finish my point really quickly here? I say I'm out of time.
Yes, because I'm not understanding your argument. So I want to understand it. So please finish.
If the court looks-
if that's okay with our presiding judge.
Yeah, you can finish the answer and you'll also have time for a rebuttal at the end.
Thank you, I'll be very brief. So when you look at the PRL, the BJB, and the DF case, when you look at those, which are cases on stays of adjudication, when you look at those, at the time of the revocation, the circumstances and the factual admissions, in fact, still existed. I believe BJB was still testing positive for meth, which was a condition. She had agreed that she would remain sober. PRL had returned to the domestic abuser and was in that relationship and was now trying to argue something differently. DF as well, I believe that they had also continued failing drug tests. So again, you have those conditions that were the factual basis were continuing. Here, we do not have that. And that's the issue. So at the time of the revocation, the county could not prove that factual, that those conditions still existed. So thank you.
And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, Ms. Dawson, counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Kelsey Kelly and I represent respondent Anoka County Human Services in this case. May it please the court, I'd like to lead off my argument by addressing the due process arguments and clarifying the record. On remand, this court instructed the district court to reopen the record if, in its discretion, it believes it necessary to make the required findings of fact based on the correct standard of law for palpable unfitness. In April, the district court issued an order to both the parties saying, asking essentially, do you want a hearing? If you want a hearing, please make an offer of proof what will occur at this hearing or what will be shown. Both parties said that they did not want a hearing. No offer of proof was made for either from either party, including Ms. Benedict, or HRB, excuse me. The fact that HRB said that she did not want an evidentiary hearing and did not make an offer of proof means that she has waived that opportunity to have an evidentiary hearing in district court. The county proceeded without a hearing because it believed the record supported palpable unfitness and the termination of rights, and that the situation was still present at the time. And if you look at that November order, when the district court did make those findings, although it was with the incorrect presumption, palpable unfitness means that the situation is going to continue into the foreseeable future. It was not unreasonable for the district court then in April and May to look at the record as a whole, based on the fact that this young girl had been out of home placement for almost half of her life in total, and that even when medicated and complying with treatment, this mother was still unable to understand the emotional needs of her daughter, that continued into the foreseeable future.
Well, could I ask you, because I view this as kind of a two-step process. I mean, first, when up on the remand, the requirement, do you agree that the district court was required to make findings or determine if there was clear and convincing evidence based on the admissions and the stipulations of palpable unfitness? Do you agree with that?
I agree that that was part of it, but the district court also would look at the record from the revocation hearing as well. And in combination of those things would make its factual findings.
Ms. Kelly, I'm having trouble. I'm not hearing you.
So I can repeat myself. So my argument is that the district court would look both at the stipulation made by HRB and look at the record at the time of the revocation hearing that was made. There were multiple witnesses. So in combination of those two things, that would result in the district court's findings of fact.
Okay, well, was there also an issue as to whether there had actually was a basis for revoking the stay of adjudication? Wasn't that also before the district court?
So yes, Your Honor, and the argument from the county is she violated the revocation in three different ways. She failed to work cooperatively with both Head Start, the guardian ad litem, and the ACSS social worker, and she was unable to understand the emotional needs of her child, which were conditions of that stay. And the stay of adjudication, the district court in March of 2019 went through the conditions of that stay over and over with her and asked her multiple times, do you understand that these are the conditions that your parental rights will be revoked if you do not comply with them? And she said yes, multiple times. There's case law, I think it's the DF case DF says that you can look at violations of the conditions of the stay, and as long as there's also, in my case, so palpable unfitness at the same time, you can revoke that stay of adjudication. I do not agree with HRB.
What's the standard? What's the standard that you need to apply in determining whether there was an adequate basis for revocation?
So I think if you're talking about factual findings, that would be clearly erroneous. So we would look at whether she failed to comply with ACSS, failed to comply with Head Start, failed to comply or work cooperatively with the guardian ad litem and failed to understand the emotional needs of her daughter for clear and convincing or for clear error. And then it would be an abuse of discretion on whether there was in fact palpable unfitness and whether the revocation was proper. And Your Honor, in this case, I don't see an abuse of discretion here. This was more than just one bad day. This was a very long-term pattern of conduct, and the fact that HRB was complying with her medications and her treatment program and still unable to understand the way her actions were impacting her daughter, unfortunately, it does show palpable unfitness. No one is doubting that HRB loves her daughter.
I'm going to paraphrase what I think the appellant is arguing here is that you said I was supposed to stay on my meds, follow up with mental health and do all these things. And I did all those things. And there's really no real change in what I was doing. There was no real change from when you gave me the stay of adjudication and I did everything you told me to do. And I had one bad day and it was only that bad day and you revoked the stay. And how do you respond to that? I mean, what changed here from the time that she was given the stay?
So the fact that she was doing all of her medications and going to all of her appointments and the fact that she still could not understand the emotional and mental needs of her daughter, that's the issue here. The issue here is the impact on her daughter and her behavior on what we're calling the bad day showed repeatedly that she was unable to understand the way her behavior impacted her daughter. When she was at Head Start and she was extremely agitated, using profanity, you know, stomping around, twirling her hair, pounding on the table with pens. Her daughter was crying in the corner, and HRB did not even notice. She was much more concerned about herself and the way the system was impacting her instead of the way the whole situation was impacting her daughter. Then later that day, when Anoka County Social Services went to her house, HRB continued to use profanity, continued to use very threatening body language, scared her daughter more. The daughter continued to cry. And unfortunately, ACSS had to remove her daughter because HRB was unable to understand the way her behavior was impacting the daughter. It wouldn't make sense to have a child stay with a parent who was medically compliant and still unable to care for a child properly. In fact, this child had been diagnosed with three different types of, behavior disorders or, you know, mental health issues as a result of being around her mother. When the child was in the foster care, the child began to blossom. And so
would you mind directing our attention to the exact conditions of the stay that you believe were violated here?
Yes. I wish I had bookmarked that. Okay. I'm looking at Exhibit A, which is on the district court's order starting at page 5. So she failed to, number 11, work cooperatively with ACSS and the guardian ad litem. She failed to 12, respectfully communicate with the daughter's teachers at Head Start. And then at the bottom here, there's a number 2 that's doesn't quite in sequential order make sense, but I'm looking at the wrong place.
Hold on a second, Ms. Kelly. For whatever reason, you're not coming through clearly right now. So why don't you start over with that?
Okay, start over with A.
No, it's not any better. Your voice is difficult to understand.
I apologize. Is it improving at all?
It is not.
I can attempt to call in.
That's better now.
Yeah, actually, we can hear you.
Oh, I apologize. Thank you. I'm glad that you can hear me now. So I was pointing out that she failed to work cooperatively with ACSS and the guardian ad litem, and that's number 11. She failed to respectfully communicate with the daughter's teachers at Head Start, which is number 12. And then, as I was saying, I was failing to find it as I was trying to read very quickly, but the big picture here is she fails to understand the way her behavior affects her daughter. And that's the point of these conditions of the stay of adjudication. They're all in place so that HRB can adequately parent her child. There, unfortunately, for some people, there is no amount of psychotherapy or medication that's going to get them to the point of being able to understand a child's emotional needs. And that's what we're looking at here. And that is palpable unfitness. I think that HRB did make great efforts, and I think that she did comply with her medication and her treatment plan, but unfortunately she still had so many deficits that she was unable to care for this child. And that's why the district court revoked the stay of adjudication.
Do you think there is a provision that deals specifically with that condition in the agreement?
I honestly can't find it right now.
I mean, I understand you can't find it, but do you believe that it's in there?
I can't find it. I'm not going to say that there is one for sure. I guess for me, the issue is the fact that these conditions are in place to direct HRB to be able to adequately parent this child. It really wouldn't make sense for the county or the court to do a stay of adjudication with conditions and then not actually apply the conditions. The whole point of child protection for conditions and for case plans is to try to get the parent on track to be able to parent without deficits for their child. And I do think that her behavior in June showed that she was unwilling to cooperate with Head Start, unwilling to cooperate with ACSS, unwilling to cooperate with the guardian ad litem. And it showed, based on the fact that her five-year-old daughter was crying on two different times in one day, and the fact that the mother did not even take the time to really notice it or help her daughter or comfort her child, shows that she's not in a position to parent. If the court has no further questions of me, I ask that the court affirm the termination of parental rights. Thank you.
Well, I have a question. You know, with regard to the revocation, does that revocation have to be shown by clear and convincing evidence?
So the actual revocation issues, yes, I believe that they do. I think the county met its burden here based on multiple witnesses testifying as to HRB's behavior, both at Head Start and at HRB's home. I think that the conditions were obviously broken here.
Further questions for Ms. Kelly?
I guess I have one last question for you. Maybe it's the last one. Maybe it's not. So Ms. Kelly, it seems to me that the actual basis for the termination, noncompliance with medication, and the conditions of the state of adjudication were not exactly the same. Would you agree with that? In other words, it wasn't simply, you know, you got to comply with your medication or else you're going to be terminated. But, you know, there are all these sort of collateral things that you have to do as well. Do you agree with that proposition?
I agree. I agree that the factual basis that she entered into was not all inclusive of all of the conditions of the stay of adjudication. The county was willing to give this parent a second chance, and that's the purpose of the stay of adjudication. The county could have proceeded in March through TPR and probably had it done at that time. Instead, they wanted to give her another chance to try to show that she could overcome the deficits that she was having. And unfortunately, this mother was not able to do that. And as I said before, the reason why we have the other conditions is sort of like a case plan in a way. And it also wouldn't make sense to keep a child in someone's care if they're medically compliant and still unable to care for that child. And the point is the fact, I know that she was medically compliant, she was going to her programming, but she still couldn't understand the emotional needs of her daughter. That's the big issue here. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kelly. Ms. Dawson, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And you're on mute right now.
Thank you. I apologize, it would not let me unmute.
That's all right.
All right, so first of all, I would like to start from the comment that was just made that the county likely would have succeeded in March. If the county likely would have succeeded in March, well, let's just not even go there because that's not where anyone chose to go. And so I believe that is improper for the county to allege. As far as the court's questioning that was just asking of the conditions of the stay, I would like to address those if I may. First of all, as far as gaining understanding about the child's needs, I would direct the court, it's under Exhibit A, it's paragraph 7. Now, paragraph 7 required the appellant to contact the child's therapist, to set up appointments, to follow her directives, and through what the way that this is worded, through the therapist, gain information and understanding as to the child's needs, have meaningful conversations, and gain knowledge about the child's behavior and trauma experience to develop a full commitment to continued engagement with services. Now, when you look at the termination of parental rights order, I would actually specifically direct the courts to paragraph findings of fact 80, finding of fact 81, finding of fact 82, 83, and 84. All of those paragraphs, the court actually finds that my client had attended these appointments. She'd had meaningful conversations. She had found them. She takes the child to the doctor. She doesn't harm the doctor. And in fact, my client under paragraph finding of fact 84 testified that she's willing to follow service provider recommendations for continued or additional treatment for the child. So when you look at the conditions under paragraph 7, which is where everybody seems to be alluding without actually recognizing that this falls under working with the child's therapist, when you look at those, the court's findings actually consider that she did comply. Then when you look at paragraph 11, working cooperatively with ACSS and the GAL, I believe by all testimony, it is clear that my client did work with
them. Well, could I ask you this because... Can I ask you this though? Because
he paused. I apologize.
Okay. Can I ask you this? Because the county also argued that paragraphs 11 and 12 of Exhibit A on page 5 were violated, and that served the basis for the stay. And the judge did make findings of fact that, you know, that she did not work cooperatively and she did not respectfully communicate as she was required to do. Are those findings clearly erroneous? I mean, isn't that our standard?
Your Honor, I believe that they are. And so when you look at it, if I could start with paragraph, I'll start with paragraph 11. By all accounts, my client did work cooperatively with ACSS and the GAL. She met with them. And again, when you look at them within this, she met with them regularly. She met with them in person and by phone. She allowed them into her home. And I realize the July 26th date, I guess I'm not going to sit here and tell the court that in any way my client's behavior was perhaps acceptable. However, when you also look at the fact that then she was informed that her child was going to be removed from her, at that point, that entirely shifts the dynamic. And again, when you look at the case law, that violation has to be substantial. There is some room, quite frankly, for emotion that when a parent is told their child is going to be removed, if we expect all parents to act perfectly in that scenario, quite frankly, no parent will meet that. No parent can be expected to act perfectly when a child is being removed. That's a gut-wrenching process for any parent.
But Ms. Dawson, how do we reconcile the fact that the court heard evidence through basically two different trials over 6 days of really a lifelong pattern of this type of behavior that was evidenced again on that July 26th date, and determine that despite all these services, nothing has really changed? How was the court in error in coming to that determination?
Well, Your Honor, I think that goes back to the argument also that some of those points that were being argued were from way prior. They were from actually the original first case and were not raised in the second case. And in fact, then when you look at, Your Honor, and if I may quickly finish this thought, actually, if I could finish two really, really quickly, I promise I'll be brief. When you look at that process, when you look at even the May hearings, by all accounts, everything was going well. She was doing everything that she needed to do. And in fact, then she had one bad day, which the guardian testified she should not be faulted for one bad day. And I would like to touch really, really briefly, if I may, on paragraph 12, which required my client to communicate respectfully with teachers at Head Start. When you actually look at the evidence, the only disrespectful communication was directed at the foster parent. And I realize again, and I'd noted this in my brief, respectful communication should generally be appreciated, but respectful communication to the foster parent was not a requirement of the stay. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Ms. Dawson. And thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your arguments and briefing in the matter. We will take the matter under advisement at this time, and we'll have a decision in the matter within 90 days.